All right. Welcome, everybody. I think we're open. We're up and running. As you can see, our guest, Stu Snyder, has really graciously joined us here. It's the middle of the summer. He's sitting in on a pier that he owns along with his lobster cartel and sharing time on a beautiful evening to spend a little bit of time with us. Stu, thank you so much, man. It's cool of you to be here.
My pleasure.
So listen, this is, you know, a wrestling podcast. Everybody that's here is interested in wrestling. Of course, everybody that's here, most of them have seen the Who Killed WCW series, which I found really fascinating. It was so well produced. I loved it. And I appreciate that you were a part of it. I didn't have anything to do with producing it, but
yeah,
you brought a level of interest and detail and a face to a name. Before we get into the wrestling stuff, though, aside from the lobster cartel that you and your family are running, it almost sounds like it could be a movie, right?
Yeah.
what else have you got going on? What'd you do after you left WWE?
So let me bring you up to speed in terms of when I left WWE. I did a tour of duty. I turned around an animation studio up in Canada called CineArt, and that was a public company. That was a company that had gone through some trouble. So I went there. Board of directors brought me in, fixed it, sold the company. And then after that, I got asked to come back to Turner Broadcasting by the chairman and CEO to basically run up a division called Animation, Young Adults, and Kids Media. And in that division, I ran Cartoon Network, Adult Swim, and a digital gaming service called GameTap. Did that for 10 years of my life. And we were coming up on the end of my contract around 2015. And that's when I bought Beale's Lobster Pier right then. And then, since leaving, I've really enjoyed what I call a third chapter of life, which is I do projects that I care about with people that I like. And I subscribe to that motto now that I am gray hair and in that third chapter. So I'm producing Broadway plays. I've got 3 shows on Broadway right now. I'll give a shout out to those great casts and teams, by the way. The first one is called Hell's Kitchen, which is Alicia Keys' new show. The second one is called Suffs, which just won 2 Tonys. Hell's Kitchen won 2 Tonys. And then the other show is called Water for Elephants, which is based on the best-selling book. So I've got that going on. I'm doing a movie with Sam Rockwell based on a very famous story out of Japan. Carlos Ghosn was arrested for embezzlement out of a Japanese company that he was running. So we're doing a movie on that. And I have Beale's Lobster Pier. And I sit on the board of some companies and I have fun. That's my life right now.
This guy just decided he was going to spend maybe an hour with us here on Every Shows. Let's give him a hand.
I knew that first of all, I agree with you, Eric. I really enjoyed the documentary. I thought it was well produced. I think the story was laid out well. I think it was, they showed all sides of kind of the story. And I figured coming out of that, there would be some drama, some heat from question marks on it. And certainly I figure over the last 20 years of the speculation and the stories of what really happened, you know, it was time to dive in with it. So when Dwayne and $7 did it, I said, I'd be happy to participate. So, and the same with the invitation to do it. I have a conversation with you about it after all these years.
Well, I very much appreciate it on a personal level, as well as, you know, yep, what our audience is going to think. So let's shift into wrestling.
Yeah.
But before we get into any of the drama, and I'll try to keep this at an hour or under, if that's okay with you.
I'm available for as long as you need me or okay. Want me.
I remember when I first got to Turner. Now, I got there in 91, and yep, I was a backup announcer, basically, pretty low level. It was me and the people that watered the plants. Everybody else was above that. But I remember hearing your name early on. I believe I did. Mm-hmm. And with Turner Home Entertainment, but I never really understood what all did Turner Home Entertainment encompass at that time.
Sure. So Turner Home Entertainment. So I was recruited to turn around and grow Turner Home Entertainment, which basically it was three groups within one. First of all, it was home video distribution. You know, back in the early 90s, home video was exploding. So it was home video, and it was also licensing and merchandising. Those were the two core divisions within Turner Home Entertainment. There was also an international group. It was a smaller group. I headed up the home entertainment, the home video group. I came on board right around the time when Ted said he wanted to be an entertainment player, not just a cable player. Okay, we had all the cable networks, but I wanted to be an entertainment player. So we went out and bought Hanna-Barbera. We went and bought New Line Cinema, and we bought Castle Rock, if you remember. I do. So we rolled all of those assets in, and that was the formation of the home video business, because the home video business was, like I said, was thriving. Our ambition was to grow. When I joined the company, it was doing about $25 million in gross revenue. Knock on wood, when Ted sold the company and we merged with Time Warner, it was doing about $450-500 million. But we took all the assets from the company, including WCW's assets, and our charge was to distribute them in home entertainment.
And I think that's probably where I heard your name, because I think Sharon Sodello would have either.
I worked with Sharon.
Right. She was our VP inside of WCW. Correct. And for people that don't know, you had Turner Corporate, and WCW was a division, so to speak, of Turner Broadcasting. And there were elements of our business model, home video, for example, international distribution is another one under your umbrella. Yeah. WCW didn't really have any control, or we didn't put any effort into it. That was all handled and managed by Turner Home Entertainment. So that was the relationship. Right. Between my division and your right. division.
And Sharon, what I remember, was your marketing person.
Right.
So Sharon weighed in on most of the marketing. So we would collaborate on what the marketing should be. And then our job was to physically go out and sell it, distribute it, get it out the door.
Very good. That's kind of what I thought, but I wasn't sure. So I appreciate the
opportunity. That's it. To clear it up. Yeah.
And so you've had two lifetimes at Turner. Because yep. 10 years is in you know, relative terms, like 18 years in another job.
Right. But
you've had two of those careers. When did the first one end?
The first one ended in 96. So Ted sells the company to Time Warner. I get an offer to join Warner Brothers out in California. And I decide, I'm not going to go move back to California, because I was based in Atlanta. I got recruited to run a company called Feld Entertainment.
Sure.
So Ringling Brothers, Disney and I, Siegfried and Roy. I went and did that, and I stayed there. And then after that, I went to the animation company and then got the offer to come back to Turner in 2005.
Okay, so where did the WWF part fit in?
99 through 2001 period.
Oh, okay. All right. I was a little confused watching the series, because it sounded like you were there beforehand. So you went there.
Yeah. So that's one of the speculations or things out there. No, I left and I went to Feld, and I was at Feld for about 3 years. And then I ended up getting recruited by WWE after my time at Feld.
Very cool. And what was your experience like at Feld? And that had to be really interesting. That was a lot different than home video and international distribution.
Yeah, it was. It actually, I was intrigued with going there, because early in my career, and this goes back to high school and college days, I promoted concerts. So I was booking shows in college. I was promoting shows, concerts. You know, my big thrill was booking Bruce Springsteen for the Broome County Memorial Arena in Binghamton, and Billy Joel.
That's kind of a big damn deal.
Right. But I'm 18, 19 years old, so I'm a punk. Even bigger. So it was what attracted me to go to Feld was basically a return to that live entertainment. I had done the movies. It's kind of like I throughout my career, I like to keep learning and growing. So I did movies. I did distribution. I was part of a big company for all of my career, but to that point. And all of a sudden, I get this opportunity to join this family business, Feld, live entertainment takes me right back to live entertainment, which I always enjoyed. So I said, yeah, let's jump off the bridge and go do that. So it had a lot of positives, at the end of the day, I didn't stay past my contract because I decided I want to return to a bigger company. I wanted to get back into different, to what I call more mainstream entertainment, which had WWE was live entertainment, pay-per-view, television, movies. You know, it was a return to that.
Did you go to them or did they come to you?
I got recruited to them.
Very cool.
Through a headhunter called me about the job.
So, yeah. Who hired you, Vince?
Oh, yeah. I reported to Vince and Linda.
Okay. All right. So tell me about your, not your first meeting, but what was the second meeting like?
Oh, my first meeting is even more fun, though.
All right, let's hear the first one. I'm skipping right to act two.
Okay. So my first, I called my first meeting with Vince was my interview. So I make it through the process. And now my last conversation is with Vince. And I met with him in the office in the New York City in the advertising. In the advertising offices. And it was great. I mean, the conversation was going fine. And then, you know, you get to the point at the interview where they say, well, what questions do you have that you have? So I said, I do have a question. And I said, can I ask you about this venture you just announced called XFL? And he says, yes. And Vince was got very serious. And he said, yes. I said, well, I'm trying to understand, you know, the positioning and the take and why you're doing it and how does it fit into the job that you want me to do? And, you know, what's the game plan? And he goes, he explains it a little bit. And then he's, you know, Vince is a genius. I mean, you know, from a standpoint of business and how he looked at life and things. And I give him a lot of credit for a lot of things. And he says, but I can tell by your question that you have some doubt. And so I said, well, I have some questions because it sounds like it's going to be very expensive, high risk. You have a very successful company. And did you ever think maybe of just buying Arena Football League? You know, you can control it, centralize it. It's in arenas where WWF at that time called WWF, you know, has tons of shows. You can leverage the arena fees, all of those things. And he looks at me and he just goes, arena football is not football, not even compared to football. And at that point, I figured I blew it. I said, I'm not getting hired. But end of the day, we went forward and I did get the job and joined the company. It was great. Great experience.
I had much the same experience. But let me ask you, did he lean forward and say, pal, arena football?
Oh, yeah.
Pal. I mean, because he's got to get in your face a little bit when he's trying to make.
Oh, no, play. No. The chest went out. The chest went out and the pal happened. And, you know, it was all the dynamics that anybody who works with him, you experience. There was the lean in and the head was tilted. And I got the whole Mr. McMahon perspective.
I bet you the reason he did hire you is because you did, in your way, challenge him professionally, you know, appropriately under the circumstances. But I learned the hard way. Vince likes to be challenged. He likes not everybody to challenge him, but he needs one or two people that he knows are not going to yes him into a bad decision.
We had a lot of those conversations over the years I was there. I was the business guy. I wasn't creative. I was the guy who had to deal with the pay-per-view deal that we were negotiating. Obviously, we're going to talk about the buying WCW, looking at other strategic investments to do. So I was the guy I saw myself as the guy who had to present opportunities, talk about tough things. And even if we didn't agree or we were going to argue, that's what the job is. And that's how I was raised with Ted Turner. And I can go back to all my bosses. So look, I worked for a guy named Jose Menendez. And and Jose Menendez, everybody can look that up, who doesn't remember, But these are all very, what I call, strong leaders who do, I agree with you, respect being challenged.
Yep.
Or else they're going to see you as a rollover, and guess what? You're of no value to them and the organization.
And we'll get to WCW, but I'm really fascinated with your role in WWE, because I think it was at a time, a really critical time in WWE, that transition from being a family-run business and a private company to taking that astronomical leap into becoming a public company, which, see, even as the words roll off my tongue sitting here all this time later, it still blows my mind that he pulled that off. Had he not done that, I don't know that we would be talking about WWE today.
I agree with you. He got, besides the money, he got legitimacy. Real, true legitimacy within the marketplace. Both bankers, the financial community, and the entire entertainment space. And I think that we would not be looking at the organization the same way if that had not happened. So, again, this is where I admire Vince, Linda, and that entire organization so much for accomplishing what they've accomplished and monetizing that organization the way they have. All the other stuff put aside, of all the bad stuff, that I admire greatly about the organization. And I even can admire the risk on XFL taking the shot, because that's Vince. I get that. That's Vince.
Yep. He really did amazing things, but I want to go back to getting the credibility by going public, because I talk about this, and the reason I want to zero in on this just for a minute is because I oftentimes refer, especially talking about contemporary, business, for whether it's AEW or WWE or whatever, you look at, in WWE's case, massive ratings on network television, on Fox. I was there. I was there the night they debuted on Fox. I was the director of that show.
Yeah.
Of SmackDown, the brand. They opened up with 3.9 million viewers, 3.8 and change viewers, which was probably less than they hoped, but pretty massive in any event. But throughout their contract with Fox, they've been hovering probably at a 2.1 million, 2.5 million range, give or take, which is pretty good. But the challenge, I think, and Fox came out and said it, they didn't renew because even though the ratings were substantial, the ad dollars just aren't there. It was way worse back before he went public. Wrestling was always a tough sell, wasn't it?
It was. And look, you touched upon it. The documentary touched upon it. Brad touched upon it in terms of wrestling and the genre. The business over-indexed on eyeballs. It under-indexed in relation to the eyeballs in the ad dollars. The other thing that it under-indexed on was holding an audience. So what happened was, and again, people came. Build it and they will come.
Right.
The challenge was holding them. And in the old linear model of a business, right, of Fox Network, Turner Networks, I was the Turner Networks at that time. And then we went to Viacom, WWF, when I was over at Viacom. The whole issue was, we pop a rating. We couldn't monetize it the way other shows monetized. But then also the audience wouldn't stay for the next show. So if you're running a network, if you're not bringing those, let's call it 3 million people or a majority of them to the next show, you're almost working harder to get the audience for the next show. And that's not the way television works. And I don't care whether it was a dramatic drama network like TNT or comedy network like TBS or my cartoon network, which is what's all about. I make sure I have a good lead in for my next show and the next show and the next show to hold the audience so they don't click the, they don't go somewhere else. And wrestling became an island if you didn't have the right show, which is why, when I was at WWE, it was one of the reasons why I spearheaded with Kevin a show called Tough Enough, which was about, a reality show about creating the next superstar, because we needed more programming to try to hold audiences.
And that was a great idea, by the way. It's like kind of cutting edge at the time. That was right on the, you know, the beginning wave of reality in the U.S. It had been around for a couple of years, but nobody ever thought we'd see it in wrestling. Yeah. That's for sure.
Yeah. It was a great idea.
I want to go back to primetime, pick your brain just for a second. Yeah. I'm sorry about interrupting you. We got a little
go. Bit. Go. Come on. Yeah. Love it.
Primetime and holding an audience. Just to be clear, wrestling itself, the island, yeah, no problem getting a whole bunch of people to show up at the island. The problem is, as soon as they closed the island, everybody left and went somewhere else.
That's right.
And I point that out because today there's a lot of conversation about AEW in the wrestling world, the number two organization by a mile. but they're in the middle of contract, supposedly negotiations, renegotiations to extend. And the number for AEW, I guess, relatively speaking, around 700,000 viewers as of last night. Whatever. I'm not sure, relatively speaking, if that's good, bad, or indifferent anymore. No comments on that. But what is interesting is they have a lead-in going right into their show is at 8 o'clock Eastern. They have a lead-in called Big Bang Theory that does pretty well. And the AEW show drops that lead-in by about 100,000 viewers within the first 7 or 8 minutes. And what I try to explain to people is the analysis isn't just how great is the AEW Dynamite rating. The analysis really comes down to, first of all, it's ad dollars, going back to what we said before, can you monetize it? And number two, what does it do to your night? And if it doesn't hold its lead in and doesn't do anything for anything coming after it, it really doesn't matter what the rating is in the, in the revenue is, because it's a big hole in your beachfront property. It's a sinkhole.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that was always the challenge of wrestling. And it's not just wrestling. There are other examples of that, but especially with wrestling. And network guys like us, we look at it from a standpoint of what are we holding for the night? And what are we retaining as eyeballs? Because you're working off promotions, like our promo spots. How many eyeballs are seeing the promo shop for the other shows that night, right? It's not just commercial dollars, it's promos. You know, are we attracting an audience if our sweet spot is 18 to 34 and the audience is leaving us? Well, how are we promoting other shows? So you've nailed it 100%. It's what's the lead-in? What are you retaining of the lead-in? How many people are showing up and how many people are leaving on the back end?
And to prove your point, and just to go back a couple of years, quite a few years at this point, to highlight it even more, one of the things that Brad came to me with when obviously Brad was at TNT running TNT and I had Nitro for WCW. And we would try, you know, I loved working with Brad. He was all extremely supportive of Nitro. He wasn't even in the room as far as I was concerned. I was in the room. Brad may have known about Ted making the decision about Nitro beforehand. I don't think that was the case, but it could have happened. But once Brad found out, either way, however he found out, he really jumped in 100%. It wasn't like I'm going to pretend I'm really supporting this because I'm really hoping it's going to crash and burn.
Right.
He named the show. I mean, it was his idea to call it Nitro because he had the Nitro block. Yeah. He convinced me, although it wasn't really my decision, it was really his, but he made me feel like I was a part of it anyway.
That means he did a good job on that.
He did a great job. And I'm glad he did, because one of the best experiences I had in terms of being an executive and learning how to develop a show and content was being exposed to some phenomenal research and focus groups. I mean, Brad said, look, if we're going to do this, let's make sure we give it 100%. And it was his budget, not mine, and put together these focus groups. And I learned so much. And I've been involved with other focus groups at WCW, but they were horrible. Bad data in, bad data out. With Brad's initiative, I went to focus groups all over the country, you know, behind a wall. They couldn't see that we were
there.
I watched them watch a show with Rheostat so we could see as a whole what they were responding to, not responding to. And then you do the Q&As with them after that portion of it. And man, a lot of what I learned in those focus groups, I took away. I kind of knew intuitively. I guess I kind of thought I knew, feeling. But when you hear people all over the country kind of singing the same song at the same key, telling you exactly what they want, it makes creating a show a lot easier. It really does. And I really appreciate it.
I've got two comments. One, I am not surprised at all knowing Brad, and I'm sure that we'll talk about that because that's one of the things on the radar screen for a lot of people, our relationship.
But I almost don't even Brad, care about. I almost don't even care
right,
about that.
Right, but hang on. But knowing, right, we'll get to there. But knowing Brad, I would expect absolutely nothing less in regards to once Ted said, "This is where we're going. Let's go." And because I lived that with Brad and Ted on a movie called Gettysburg. So I lived that type of thing, which was Ted made the movie Gettysburg, short story. And it was going to go on TNT first. That's where it was going to air. And I put my hand up and I went, excuse me, we can make more money for the company if you don't put it on TNT first. Throw it into the movie theaters, even for a week, and I'll put it out on video, and this is how much money we'll make. And then you could run it simulcast on TNT, and we'll have our cake and eat it too. And Brad kind of went, wait a minute, I'm not going to get a premiere on Gettysburg? What? Wait a minute, what? And then, but we went through the process, and then once the decision was made, he was on board, fully supportive. So I've seen, you know, look, I've known him for a long time, and professionally, I would expect nothing less. So, on research, my philosophy on research, intuitively, you knew the right answers, by the way. I believe that. And by the way, any of us who do this job long enough, we intuitively know the right thing. So we're getting confirmation from a larger group. Mm-hmm. We're looking for the large fuck up. Uh-oh, don't do that. Because they're going to hate that idea. That's what you do, the major set of the research, to avoid the fuck up.
Well, one of the other things that I remember working with Brad is trying to cross promote because we had this powerhouse of an island called Nitro, but it wouldn't hold an audience. And Brad was trying to figure out how to make it work. So right around that time, he developed a special called the Adventures of Robin Hood. And Brad had this idea. I would say we had it because Brad came to me and we collaborated to a large degree, but a way to use Nitro. What I did is I extended Nitro. I went over our allotted time into the time for this premiere of Adventures of Robin Hood. And then we would break into the show. I think that's how we had it set it up. So we were continuing Nitro into this premiere of this episode, some kind of a configuration like that. I don't remember the details, but even that, with all of that effort and the power that we had with Nitro, as soon as our part of that little stunt was over, out, they're gone.
Yep.
That was the nail in that coffin. We didn't try that too many times after that.
Got it.
So let's go back. We're talking about Brad. How did you first meet Brad?
I was at MGM UA in the non-theatrical division. And I had the Southeast Territory. My job, straight out of college. I remember college, I book all the films and the concerts. Well, now I went to work for one of my companies that I book movies from, MGM UA. So I'm booking movies to colleges, prisons, libraries, nursing homes, non-theatrical stuff. And Brad was running the College Television Network in New York. That's where we met. So we figured out, okay, what do you do? What do I do? Licensed movies. Maybe we do something together. It just are the two companies. And that's how we met. And we stayed in touch for all those years as we both kind of grew up in the business. And then we went separate ways. You know, he went with his career. I went with my career out to California and really didn't connect until I came to Turner about 6 months after Brad joined Turner to run TNT. I showed up because Ted was, you know, arming the company with executives. I came on to do Turner Home Entertainment. Brad was hired out of AMC to run TNT. So about 6 months later, I show up. That small world. Well, the whole business is a small world.
It is.
So that's how we really reconnected at Turner after all those years. Because it was early 80s when we first met. And I joined Turner in 93 the first time around.
Okay. So you've got a relationship with Brad through Turner. You've worked with Brad for quite a while. You end up leaving. You do Feld, stop away, stop a couple of places along the way. You end up in WWE. And honestly, I don't remember dates. I don't have any notes. I'm not that guy.
I'm not that guy either.
WCW goes up for sale. Was it 2000 or 2001? Do you remember?
I'm thinking 2000. I'm thinking, and again, I have no memory. I want to be clear. I'm thinking it went first time around 2000, the end of 2000, around that time period.
No, I think you're right. In fact, I know you're right.
Okay.
Now that I think about it. Because I got let go in 99, and then Brad brought me back in 2000. Okay. Shortly thereafter. How did you first hear about it? Do you know? Just read about it?
Oh, yeah. It would have been everywhere. First of all, the news is everywhere. Okay. I'm reading the same trade magazines everybody else is reading. I'm reading the same wrestling stuff that everybody else is reading. So, you know, I keep reading about, frankly, how the business is not going well. Let's focus on the business. The business is out there that the perception is it's not going well. Perception is Turner as an organization is not happy with the way the business is. And then I frankly thought about my friend Brad, who's taken a beating in the press and running, you know, for lots of different reasons. What I call real, unreal, doesn't matter. Just the copy that I'm seeing. And what I recall is, even before the company was for sale, because remember I mentioned earlier, Eric, that we were in a mode at WWF, we were looking for businesses to buy. We were in expansion mode. We had just gone public. I could tell you three other deals that I was looking at. And I picked up the phone and I called Brad. And there were two things I said. Uh-oh. I said.
No, I thought you froze up for a second on my end. I thought we lost you. We got you.
Oh, okay. There were two reasons for the call. One is, Brad, how are you doing? I wanted to see how my friend was doing just as a colleague. How are you hanging in there? Because I just keep reading shit. That was number one. Number two is I said, hey, I don't know if any of this gossip is real or not, what I'm reading and speculation about WCW. But if you guys get to a point where you want to do something with the company, we're looking to buy things, we might be interested. That was a very simple conversation, short and sweet. He said, all right, I'll keep you posted. And that's how that start. That's how I recall everything started from there.
And again, the dates, if either one of us had them, it would be helpful, but either one of us do. I'll just give you my side of that equation. Yep. That's probably right around that same time. I got sent home by Harvey Schiller. I think it was a decision of Vicki Miller, head of finance made.
Vicki Miller. I remember Vicki.
Yeah. Don't get me started. But
I understand. Keep going.
But I had 2.5 years left on my deal. So I wasn't a big, you know.
Right.
Emotionally, it was a big deal. Don't get me wrong. But it wasn't like, oh my God, what am I going to do tomorrow? Right. So I went home, and after about 48 hours, I was like, rearview mirror, brother. I'm off to the next project. I'm good. Sure. I get a phone call from Brad sometime around February. It's right around the Super Bowl. And Brad said, okay, because they paid or played me. They had to pay me, and I didn't have to go back. So Brad asked me, what's it going to take for you to come back? I had an agent over at William Morris at the time, David Tinsler. Basically renegotiated a deal. They paid off my initial contract, wrote me a new one, and gave me a three movie deal, put deal on TNT or Turner Broadcasting, TNT or TBS. And my agent thought we could leverage that and, you know, get into the movie making business a little bit.
Sure.
So I went back, worked for a few months. Things were worse than when I left the first time. And I was there as a consultant. So I wasn't in the middle of it all. Wasn't reporting to anybody other than Brad on the creative stuff. But it was bad. It was really bad. And a couple of incidents happened. One in particular in July at a pay-per-view. Brad made the decision to send me home again. Mm-hmm. And shortly after that, now that's in July. Before that, early in January or February, when Brad first called me, I suggested to Brad, and I think I said something very close to Brad, because I had that relationship with him. Why don't you think about selling WCW while it still matters? You guys, it's clear nobody in this company wants it to be here. It doesn't fit this corporate profile. Sell it. And he laughs at me. You heard my comment in the documentary. It was like, we don't sell things here. We buy things. And
right.
I just laughed it off and went, okay. Call me back a couple months later, maybe a month later, and ask me if I was serious. And then that's how the Fusion Media deal began. A guy by the name of Peter Goober hooked me up with Brian Bedell, Steve Greenberg, and we were off and running. So that it's interesting that you saw the opportunity right about the time I'm trying to convince Brad, maybe it's time to sell. Obviously, there was some resistance during that period of time, but ultimately they decided to sell.
Yeah.
I guess the confusing part for me, and anybody that's tuning into this to think that this is going to get confrontational, kind of gotcha, you can go ahead and sign off now because that's not what this is. This is me just trying to fill gaps in my own head. Because there's a lot of them. Time does funny things to you. But I guess the confusing thing to me is we put the Fusion deal together. Bedell and Greenberg threw in $3 million or $5 million of their own money. It might have been $3 million of their own money. And then I was a part, to a limited degree, of raising money on Wall Street from institutional investors as well as private investors for the balance that ended up being, I believe, either 62 or 67 million. Put the offer on the table, offers accepted. We go into due diligence, which was lengthy for obvious reasons. It's a lot of shit to sort out. We start due diligence somewhere in there. I don't have the date, didn't write it down, didn't Google it. We do a conference call, Wall Street, with everybody that mattered, CNN, everybody that was interested, where we jointly, along with, I was on the call, Brian Bedell, Steve Greenberg, and I think it was Brad. Might have been somebody else from Turner. And just lay the whole thing out. Deal's done. It was a purchase agreement. If you're buying a business, isn't like buying a house, but if it was, you make an offer, the offer's accepted, sign off on a purchase agreement, and then you got to wait to close. And that's kind of the position we were in, thinking we were going to be done. And just seems like out of nowhere, I get a call from Bedell that says, okay, the deal just blew up. We're not doing it. And the only answer I got was Jamie Kellner decided he didn't want wrestling on the network. That was easy to accept for me. I mean, easy in one sense. Pissed me off to no end at the time. But it kind of fit into the way I saw things unfolding anyway at Turner. But the fact that the deal was done, it had been announced, and they pulled the plug the way they pulled the plug, I think that's the reason why there's so much curiosity. And I saw your comments, sure, by the way, in the documentary, when you said that if Turner had a deal on a table for $60 million, they'd have taken it. They did. It was 62. Now, but how that deal was structured, I wasn't a part of how that deal was structured.
Right.
So I didn't have any firsthand knowledge of the details of that deal, other than it had been submitted and it had been accepted. And we talked about it on a Wall Street conference call.
So I'm going to fill in a few gaps for you. So, and you may or may not know this or recall this, but let me fill in some gaps. After my phone call, and I said, hey, how are you doing? And if you want to do something ever, we might be interested. We're an obvious buyer, if you're interested. Somewhere after that period is when Turner and WWF started having a conversation about acquiring WCW. Okay? I can't tell you a date or a time period. Was it a month or 2 months? I don't recall that. But we actually had a deal done, closed. We had agreed on a price. Brad was only one player of the Turner team involved in that negotiation.
Was Steve Heyer another one?
Exactly. So I had all these folks who I knew from my previous life were at the table, and we were paying, I'll put it this way, Eric, we were paying a lot of money our offer was for a lot of money for WCW the first go round. And we had our exclusive deal with Viacom. So the deal with us was we were taking the shows off of Turner. We were going to go with Viacom because we couldn't have the shows on Turner. So Vince's perspective, because one of the things Vince and I chatted about was, you know, Vince, we have to get Viacom on board with airing more wrestling. They're not just going to go, oh, here's two more hours. We already had 2 hours. So, and Vince, in his magnanimous way, said, don't worry, we'll make it happen. Okay, got it. So, you know, that was Vince had his very good relationship there at Viacom. I knew the players there, but Vince obviously was dealing at the top with Preston. So we negotiated a deal. I flew down to Turner Broadcasting on the jet. We had a deal. We then go to Viacom and say, we have a deal to buy WCW. We need 2 more hours on the Viacom networks. Viacom said no.
Whoa.
So I want to be clear in terms of timeline here, because I know, and this is how I know my timeline. And this is part of one of my, you know, funny stories. All I remember about Yom Kippur 2000 is that I worked all day on Yom Kippur in my apartment in New York on the deal. So we had done this deal, brought it to Viacom. They said no. We then had to pick up the phone and call Turner, Steve Heyer, Brad Siegel, the lawyers, and go, we can't move forward.
So that all happened.
I believe, Eric, what I believe happened at that point, and I could be wrong, but I believe that opened up the door for you and Fusion to negotiate your deal. Okay?
That actually is the only thing that makes sense. Knowing that piece of the equation, because there were just elements of it, like the Spike deal.
Yeah.
We're probably out there in the public, but, you know, I don't spend a lot of time.
But I will tell you, Eric, in all the years, in the 20 years, and, you know, I spoke to Guy Evans, you know, and there I saw all the chatter about, you know, the deal, right? I never saw it, that chapter really fully explained, because the reality is we had a deal with them to buy it and got blocked by Viacom. So we couldn't proceed. And then my memory is you went back in with Fusion, whatever that was, had made it an arrangement again. And I thought that that deal was moving forward. I wished Brad and Steve Heyer all the best. I said, I'm pissed. We can't do it. So I thought this was happening. And then I was kind of heard the word that said, wait a minute, Jamie or somebody at Turner said, I don't want wrestling on the airways. You know, you guys don't, whatever. I don't want it. And then my perception was that's what impacted the deal with Fusion. That opened up the door that it was available once more. Because it circled back to me after that point.
This is fun. So, I mean, it all makes sense. I could see how the timeline played out, because the first time I suggested it, you know, Brad just laughed at me in a friendly way, but you know what I mean? Just, you know, okay, yeah, right, Eric, go do your wrestling thing. Leave me alone. And then all of a sudden, a couple months later, hey, Eric, do you think you could put a deal together? And at the time, of course, I said, sure, absolutely. And had no clue how to do it, but I figured it out. But the Jamie Kellner piece then still holds up as being that moment. And the only question is, I guess, not in my mind, actually, because I don't really give a fuck. But at this point, you know what I mean? It's not going to affect my life.
Yeah.
But the only question is, internally, did someone help Jamie? Did someone convince Jamie to kill that deal?
Oh.
That's one question. The other question that I saw the other day, it was more of a statement, was that Steve Heyer had structured the Fusion deal or had agreed. I should call Brian Bedell and ask him, like, didn't do it. But Steve Heyer had either agreed or structured the deal, probably agreed, that would have allowed, should anything happen to WCW, Bedell's group, essentially, Fusion, would be able to program those 2 hours of TNT or that programming time. That's apparently what Kellner saw, and one of the reasons, if not the reason, why he put a bullet in it. Because so you kind of got to understand that.
Yeah. Oh, no, I will tell you, and I truly know nothing, okay, about what happened over at Turner's side. But I can only speculate, like the rest of the world is speculating. But knowing a little bit about Steve Heyer, who I also respect, and Jamie is a programmer. Steve is ad sales. Okay, I just want to give you a little bit of the roles.
Yeah, that's kind of like mutually exclusive destruction.
So you have the ad salesperson and you have the programmer, where ad sales obviously fits into programming. Jamie was true at his core a programmer. So he's looking at ratings and also numbers, but a flow of programming. Remember, we talked about flow of programming. Mm-hmm. The idea of giving up an hour or two in prime time to another company to go put on something, whatever the hell they want to do, without Jamie or the network approving it, could rub them a wrong way. Let me put it that way. Could basically, and I'll give you an analogy. I once was offered, somebody came to me at Cartoon Network and Adult Swim and offered me a lot of money. I mean, a lot of money, to buy 5 hours of my day part. Mm-hmm. And I had no say. And we had lots of provocative conversations within the organizations. And I ultimately turned it down and said no, because I had no idea what the programming would be. And I couldn't give up 5 hours of day part. I could see Jamie going, wait, 2 hours of programming? That's my beachfront property where I get the highest CPMs. I secure the highest revenue from, and I don't know what the program is. I could actually see him saying, what are we doing here? So yeah, I don't know if any of that is real or not. I'm just saying I could see the point of doing it. And from a standpoint, I think Jamie made a decision that just said, okay, well, I'll do a deal to sell the company for whatever the money is, but made a decision, from what I can tell, just said, I don't want it on the network anymore. I want the real estate for other ideas.
And the other question I had for you, may or may not know this, but to your knowledge, did Heyer and Jamie Kellner have a good, bad, unhealthy relationship?
I do not know for sure. I just heard it was a professional, but competitive.
That makes sense. Programmer had sales.
Well, they both, you know, the end of the day, from what I recall, two bright individuals, two bright executives, money, programming, and both wanted to run the company.
There you go.
You lived the corporate life. You lived the corporate life. You saw a little bit of that.
I did. Stu, this has been a blast, brother.
Filled
in some blanks, and I'm going to get your number from Evan.
Yeah, please.
My wife and I have never been to Maine. We always talk about going to Maine. One of these days we're going to get there, and I'm going to call you and you're going to give me a tour.
You have two things going. I want to make sure you know. One, absolutely get my number and all my data and let me know. You have an open invitation here, my guest. Number two is, you have an open invitation because I'm going to send you a whole bunch of lobsters that you're going to love out there in Wyoming, because I know that I'll ship them to you because we ship nationwide. I'm going to send you a love package.
Not only that, dude, I'm going to start putting your stuff over in our podcast. You're going to be shipping lobsters to wrestling fans all over the world.
Well, you know, we've been around for 90-something years. Crap. We ship a lot of boxes.
That's awesome. I'll have
put us any together. Any questions from anybody on your team?
Because that was for a few minutes.
Evan, that's your call.
Questions for Stu, though, not for me.
Boys and Blobs.
Evan?
Danielle, you there with us?
Yes, I'm
Hi,
here.
Danielle.
Hi.
What do you Hi, got Danielle. For us?
My question is, Mr. Snyder, thank you for coming on, first of all, but are you surprised at how much interest is still in all of the WCW chatter throughout the wrestling universe, even so many years later?
You know, I guess I have to answer it this way. I am and I'm not. You know, 20 years is a long time. So that's just from a you know, just timeline. However, knowing wrestling fans and knowing how wrestling fans felt about and feel about WCW in those, that era, and also feel about WWE, and wrestling fans are amazing. I mean, they're so passionate. They love the sport. They love the format. They love the guys and the women. I'm not surprised. And frankly, it's a good, juicy story with a lot of tons of speculation of what really went down. So I completely get it and understand it.
And when I go out to visit Stu at his lobster cartel, he's going to tell me the real story.
We got to keep it going. Exactly. It was too, right? Exactly, Eric. It was too, yeah, there's a real story too.
Thank you, Dan.
It's such a simple story, and it really is at the end of the day.
It's
what good. Else?
What else you got?
We got little Jimmy Sorensen up next.
Hey, Jimmy.
Hey, guys. Eric, always a pleasure talking to you. Mr. Snyder, why, in your opinion, do you think a lot of people have blamed Eric for so many years unjustly? Why do you think that has been the case? Because you had a C-spot announcer turned prophet for a multi-million dollar organization, and a bunch of corporate executives just never wanted it on their networks or around in general.
Thank you, Jimmy.
Okay, so I'll answer it this way. First of all, Eric should get all the credit in the world for building WCW into what it was. WCW, you know, look, I was there. Again, Eric, thank you for pointing out. I was there during the beginning of the growth. All right, 93, I left the 96, 97 era. I was beginning to see the bubbling. Ted signed, you know, we were buying talent, bringing it on board. You knew what to do with it. So Eric should get all the credit in the world for building it. The reality of the jobs that we sit in, Eric sits in, jobs I sit in, and others, we get the good news and we take the crap and the shit when things don't go as well as we want it to go. So he's an easy target because he was in the chair of leading the organization. He had a lot of stakeholders to share on what happened there. He had a lot of divided agendas there. I said in the documentary that wrestling inside a company like Turner Broadcasting was, one could say, doomed from the very beginning, because ultimately to compete, you have to do storylines and do drama that will not always match up with standards and practices. And also the financials are not going to add up for a public company like a Turner Broadcasting or a Time Warner or AOL at that time, by the way. So, you know, it's kind of like the minute the dip happens, uh-oh, wait a minute, why are we in this business? Why, what are we doing here? So I think that there is a lot of, there's no villain to why WCW didn't continue or didn't succeed. It had enormous success. It had its ride. It was under an organization that was done with it, candidly. And then it needed to be set free. I'm sad. I'll give you my own personal take on something. I'm sad that WWF didn't find a way to really creatively keep it alive.
Because that would have done it. If you guys would have been able to work Viacom, that would have kept the brand alive. And who knows where
exactly.
Today.
But And by the way, the other thing is, we still, again, Vince's plan, the creative team's plan, in earnest, was to try to keep it alive within even the two programmings and so forth. But I was sad that the company didn't find a way creatively to keep the brand alive and to keep it going. That was one of the things when you look back, you know, I look back on my career and I go, damn, I wish they would have figured that out.
Yep.
So.
Thanks, Jimmy. We have one more, Evan.
Yeah, we've got two folks on deck, if that's all right.
That'd be fine.
Bring us right at the top of the hour. And yeah, we wouldn't be a Zoom without Coach Rosie. So, Coach, what's going on?
Man, Stu, I'm looking over at my 18-year-old son and thinking about all the shows we watched together on Cartoon Network. But here's my question. Here's my question, buddy. You're a jack of all trades. You've done the circus. You've done wrestling. You've done movies. You've run Cartoon Networks. You've done it all.
Broadway plays.
Of everything that, yeah, exactly. Of all the things that you've done, which was the most fun for you?
If you're backing me up against a wall and you're making me answer the question, because I can give you the truth of it. I've had an amazing, wonderful career. I've loved every gig that I've been in, but if you're backing me up against the wall, I would say the 10 years running Cartoon Network, Adult Swim, and the kids business at Turner and Time Warner was probably, I can look back because I'm really proud of shows like Rick and Morty and Adventure Time awesome. And Regular Show and Steven Universe. And, you know, when I walked into the chair at Cartoon, we were irrelevant. The network was irrelevant. It was not doing well in ratings. I had the privilege of bringing on some amazing talent to the company to work with me to reinvigorate Cartoon Network with new shows and new attitude. And I'm really proud of our Stop Bullying, Speak Up campaign that we did with the White House. So if I'm pushed up against the wall, I would say I'm most probably most proud of that team of the 10 years, you know, that I had running that organization.
Well, as thanks, a public Coach. School teacher, yep, see you.
Sorry, no, Coach, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to jump your brother. I just wanted to add to your question, Coach. Do you think part of the reason you enjoyed that time, Stu, was Ted and working under Ted? Because he was different. I mean, Vince was in many ways the same way, but it had because you worked closer with Ted than I did, obviously. That had to be a blast, man.
So here's reality. I got to work with Ted my first time at Turner. By the time I came back, Ted was already out of the company.
Oh, that's right.
So, but Teddy, you know, Teddy worked for me, you know. I don't know if you remember that. Teddy was my Southeast sales manager.
Oh, that's awesome.
So, Ted and I, when I came back the second time in 05, Ted had his place in Atlanta. And so we stayed in touch the entire time. But he was out of the company. I just spent a week at his ranch in New Mexico, which, by the way, I highly recommend. It's amazing, Vermejo. So the Ted era was really my first go-around, first 4 years. It was Ted and Sasa and Phil Kent and, you know, had a blast building that company. Second time, it was not Ted, but he was hovering around. But it was a blast because it was a business. I like going to places that need that are hurting or needed to growth plan or need a next step. That company needed it. So I enjoyed it the most. And then we just, you know, did the research. You mentioned research. We did the research. We did the homework. We figured out the right programming and it was a great time. Great fun time.
Thanks, Coach.
Awesome. Thanks, Coach. We got our final question of the night, Mr. Epic.
By the way, I love all the names. Mr. Epic. Where's Mr. Epic?
It's a great right here. How are we doing, man?
I know. Where's Mr. Epic?
There we go. How are we doing?
How are you, Mr. Epic?
All right. On the road, as always. Finally heading home after a long week on the road. So I know, WCW ended in 01. Now, just to simplify the question, if it did last a little bit longer, I mean, the dot-com fallout was right around the corner. Like, AOL stock, if I remember correctly, dropped a significant amount, like a few months later. Like, if it, even if it survived and they kept it on, like, would it even have survived the dot-com fallout? AOL, like, they lost a good percentage when they, the dot-com boom blew up.
So I want to make sure I understand the question. Are you asking me if the dot-com bust didn't happen, you think it would have stayed on the network on Turner?
No. If it did stay on, like, how much do you think, I mean, the dot-com fallout, like, would have affected it?
Oh, so what I recall is the dot-com, we were already in the middle of the dot-com bust. By 2001, that really hit 2000. So, because we were feeling the pain over at WWF, we were no different than anybody else. You know, we had a dot-com business, and then it just went into the crapper and the shitter. So we experienced it. Everybody was experiencing it, and certainly AOL Time Warner was experiencing it with their share price going down and everything. So there was blood on the street, as we all know. I don't really believe, and again, I don't have anything to prove this. This is just one person's opinion. I don't believe that is what created why WCW was not going to be on the Turner networks. And I also don't believe that that impacted why WCW didn't succeed with Vince at WWF. I think they wanted it off the Turner networks for all the reasons we talked about, which was it was an island. It didn't make enough money for those hours. I truly do believe Jamie wanted other programming for that time period. And again, I respect that Eric and Fusion had a deal, but I don't think he wanted to give up that time slot for someone else to program, is all my speculations there. And I just think creatively WWF couldn't figure out a way to integrate WCW in the storylines that excited viewers. But I had left by then, so I really don't know if that was true. I just know that they killed it after they bought it. And by the way, I always said, and have always said, one of the reasons I was attracted to buying WCW was not just about the television shows, but because of the library of programming. Because the one thing I truly believed in, and I said this to anybody within WWF, because I was the guy, I was the point guy on the deal. I said, what's valuable here long-term, in my opinion, was the library. Because while the dot-com bust was happening, I looked down the road of the future, and the future I absolutely believed was online and streaming and so forth. And I said, that library, especially for the wrestling fan, is going to have a lot of value downstream.
Yeah, so, the return on the investment of that WCW video library for WWE is probably one of the
probably best very good.
Yes. And that makes sense, Stu, given your background in home video. Right. That's kind of
exactly.
You knew that market.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw where the world was headed. First there were cassettes, and then there were DVDs, and then there was Netflix, and then there was streaming. You know, I could see the way the world was going, and I'm looking at a library that I figured, you know, shit, I'm going to want to watch Hulk Hogan against Andre the Giant, you know, 5 years from now. Who's not going to want to watch that stuff? So that to me was really an exciting part of the deal.
Stu, it's been exciting to have you. It's really been a pleasure.
Same here.
I can't wait to sit down and have a lobster tail with you at some
point. I want to get your stuff. I'm going to come out to Wyoming. I'm going fishing in Oregon next weekend. And I know about you and fishing, so I'll have to come. We'll coordinate trips or something. We'll
get together. Yeah, because fly fishing is outstanding here, especially like September, October.
I've heard.
But yeah, definitely. All right, man. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. Thank you, Stu, very much. Evan,
my pleasure.
Thanks for setting it up.
All right. Take care. So, bye, everybody.